This is Dr. J with Change Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your radio tuned to the left and your mind in the open position as we present a sexy high-tech vision of our radically democratic future. I'm speaking today with Dr. Peter Singer, the recently appointed DeCamp Professor in the University Center for Human Values at Princeton University. Professor Singer began his career at Oxford University, was appointed to a professorship at his home university of Monash in Australia at the age of 30, has served as president of the International Association of Bioethics, and as editor of its official journal, Bioethics. His many books have been translated into 15 languages and have been widely taught in ethics classes throughout Europe and the United States. His book, Animal Liberation, is seen as a milestone in the erosion of human centrism in ethics and the birth of the animal rights movement. Professor Amy Gutman, director of the University Center for Human Values at Princeton, says Professor Singer has remained deeply committed to arguing for the reduction of suffering in the world through the avoidance of famine and the humane treatment of all sentient beings, the ethical treatment of animals, and the improvement of the environment for the benefit of all. He also has found time to reflect on what it means to live a good life, reviving the time-honored idea that turning away from self-centeredness and towards the urgent needs of others makes for a satisfying life. Welcome, Dr. Singer.
It's good to be with you.
Now, you're one of the foremost articulators of a utilitarian ethics. Can you summarize briefly what a utilitarian ethics approach is? Are you a rule-based utilitarian? Do you believe in utilities higher than pleasure and so forth?
Well, as a utilitarian, I'm concerned that the actions that we should do should be those that have the best consequences. Now, I think that I would describe myself as a utilitarian who is aware of the fact that in trying to work out what has the best consequences, you can't calculate everything from scratch. You can't, each time you have to decide what to do, begin from the ground up. So I would support the idea of rules or principles, what some people call rules of thumb, but I would not support the idea of a totally inflexible rule-based approach that says once a rule is in place, and if it's better to have that rule or not, that is, if the consequences of following the rule are better than the consequences of not having a rule at all, that then you should act in accordance with the rule, no matter what you might know about the exceptional nature of the present case, which means that it would be worse to act in accordance with the rule.
And one of the central principles in your work has been articulating the a sentience, that is, the ability to experience pain. Is that how you would define sentience? And personhood. Can you talk about the relationship between sentience and personhood?
Yeah, well, sentience I use as a shorthand expression for the ability to feel pain or pleasure or to have any other kinds of mental experiences. To be the subject of experiences would be one way to put it, to be aware of things, to have awareness. That's, if you like, what gets you into the moral community in the sense of the community of beings who matter. That is, your experiences are then of intrinsic moral significance. If you're not aware of anything, they're not even that. But insofar as the wrongness of killing is concerned, I think it's significant to draw a further distinction, and that is between those beings who are self-aware. By that I mean capable of seeing themselves as independent beings existing over time, and those beings who, though they might have some awareness, that is, they might be able to feel something or to suffer, don't have the conception of themselves as a distinct object, just a distinct kind of being that had a past and will have a future.
Now, on the basis of those distinctions, with the book Animal Liberation and then subsequently The Great Ape Project and In Defense of Animals, you've argued that most of the practices that we have towards animals and animal husbandry are indefensible on those grounds.
Yes, I think that animal husbandry certainly is practiced in the United States and many other countries, is premised on the idea that animals are just things for us to use. That is, that we breed them and we use their flesh or their eggs or whatever else it might be, without any real consideration for their interests, only to the point at which, you know, if they are so suffering that they are not even going to produce well for us. But that's pretty far down the track. So, for example, if it's cheaper to produce eggs from hens who are kept in wire cages so small that they can't even stretch their wings, then that's what producers are going to do. And in fact, there are, you know, producers who don't do that are going to be struggling to compete with those who do. So that's a system that gives no real role to the animal's own interests in having a decent sort of life, in having the ability to satisfy his or her natural instincts. And that's why I think that really the principles that I put forward, which are that animal suffering counts, that it doesn't count any less just because it's an animal than similar human suffering would, I think that does rule out a great deal of animal-based agriculture in the United States today.
Now, the argument against anthropocentrism has been pretty radically pursued by the deep ecologists and animal rights activists for the last 25 years, and it seems fairly incontrovertible to me. I grew up with that argument, and the belief in human-centric ethics is based on religious beliefs, primarily, that are kind of foreign to me. But do you think that we're making headway with a non-anthropocentric ethics? I know that in New Zealand now they're taking seriously the law that you've proposed with the Great Ape Project to ban experimentation on simians.
Well, the law has actually been passed in New Zealand now,
oh, good,
I'm pleased
good.
To say. So, yes, in New Zealand you cannot... you cannot experiment on a great ape, that is a gorilla, chimpanzee, bonobo, or orangutan, unless it's for the benefit of great apes themselves. You can't do it for human benefit. So that's a step forward, and I welcome that, obviously. I think that people are starting to, you know, accept to some extent and this viewpoint that animals do matter in themselves. And, I mean, it happens at different ends of the scale. On the one hand, with the species that are a bit more like us, you could say, the great apes, the ones that have demonstrated their intelligence and awareness and so on, we are starting to actually stop their use in experiments. And, of course, we don't use them for food, although there is still a great threat to them in their natural habitat from humans who do use them for food. But, at the other end of the scale, with farm animals, we find in Europe that there's been significant progress in really getting rid of some of the worst abuses that happen to animals on factory farms. For example, the battery cage is now going to be phased out over the next 12 or 13 years or so in Europe.
It's a rack of cages stacked up on top of each other.
Exactly, that's right. It's the standard method of producing eggs in the United States. They're probably, as we speak, somewhere in excess of 200 million hens living this way in the United States. They don't have room to stretch their wings. They can't scratch on any litter because they're on a bare wire floor. They can't lay their eggs in a nest or anything like a nest. These are all things that are quite instinctive and remain important to hens, even if they've never really been used to doing it. So, you know, that's going to disappear in Europe, and yet in the United States we've not taken any steps towards getting rid of it yet. So the United States is really becoming a very backward country as far as animal welfare is concerned.
Now, one of the commandments that you proposed in Rethinking Life and Death was that we recognize that the worth of human life varies from life to life, and presumably on the basis of the varying amounts of personhood and the varying amounts of sentience. Just to stay with animals for a second, does that idea of varying value of life give people an out? For instance, in animal husbandry, if we could come up with an ultra-kosher way to kill animals without pain and without their anticipating their own deaths, would that be a more ethical approach to animal husbandry?
Well, anything that reduces the amount of pain that animals experience is better if you know, take the premise that animals are going to be killed for food. of course, you know, we ought to be concerned not only with the suffering in killing, but in the suffering in raising all the way through their lives and in transporting and the rest of it. So so you would still have a long way to go if you just take account of the killing situation. But I suppose you could say that, yes, I mean, I do think that the wrongness of killing a being varies with the nature of its capacities, and you might argue on that basis that if you didn't cause suffering to animals at any stage during their existence and then you killed them painlessly without them expecting it, that would, well, at the very least, it would greatly reduce the wrongness in what we're doing to animals now when we produce them for food.
I guess I was actually conflating two things there, the nature of the killing and the nature of the being. I guess the nature of the being question would be something on the order of, is eating shrimp different from eating cows in your worldview?
I think eating shrimp is different from eating cows, which is not to say that I eat shrimp myself, because I think shrimp still have some sort of nervous system, even if a much more rudimentary one, I guess, than cows do. And you know, you could ask questions, you could raise doubts about whether shrimp can feel anything. So it's in a grey area. I give them the benefit of the doubt, but undoubtedly they're you know, a simpler organism than a cow, and I think that there's a different issue. But you know, you could also you could point out, of course, that most people, when they eat shrimps, will eat several shrimps, whereas it will take several people to eat a cow. So if there is a bit of suffering in the shrimps, and certainly the way they...
You're multiplying it.
You're multiplying it, and they also are not killed humanely, which you know, maybe, if things go well, the cow is.
That's actually an old Tibetan argument for eating cows. They say the karma of eating one cow is less than the karma of eating many, many chickens. So,
yeah, well, maybe we should move on to elephants or perhaps the blue whale or something of that sort. But I prefer to do none of this and to stick with tofu and various good, perfectly excellent vegetarian alternatives.
Now, the views that have caused the firestorm since your appointment at Princeton have to do with neonatal intensive care making decision-making. In practice, many parents and pediatricians decide not to continue life-sustaining treatments for severely disabled newborns, just as many doctors and relatives decide to end the lives of terminally ill or permanently unconscious loved ones. And many physicians draw an ethical distinction between pulling out a feeding tube or giving a shot of morphine, and yet many of us bioethicists and many people in the general public don't see a big distinction between pulling out a feeding tube and giving a shot of morphine. So, in sum, your argument has been that just as it is sometimes more compassionate to allow people to choose death at the end of life when it's going to reduce their suffering, even if it's an act, they have to take an active role, or a physician has to take an active role in causing that death. Sometimes it would be more ethical to allow severely disabled newborns, who are even less morally significant because of their not being persons yet, to be euthanized and therefore start over with a less troublesome life.
That summarizes the argument pretty well, I think, yes. And I think a lot of people who get outraged by my position here don't really sit down and think about, well, what is it that we're doing now already? And how different is that from what I'm suggesting?
Right. Because in most neonatal intensive care units, those decisions are made in a kind of quiet way all the time.
Yes, and people will justify it by sort of mumbling something to themselves like, well, we're just letting nature take its course. But, you know, I mean, the whole existence of a newborn, of a neonatal intensive care unit, its whole raison d'etre is to stop nature taking its course. So if you're going to let nature take its course in some cases but not others, you've got to take responsibility for what you're doing. You've got to face it. You've got to say, look, I'm making a decision that it's better that this infant should die now.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are two kinds of suffering that are prevented if a newborn who is severely disabled is allowed to die. There's the suffering of the newborn, which disability rights advocates can contest. And then there's the indisputable suffering or burden on a family, which I guess some would contest as well, the joy of having a disabled person in the family and so forth. Are those the two factors that you take into account, or do you also include larger social costs?
The two that you mentioned seem to me to be the primary ones, especially in a reasonably affluent nation like the United States. Because if you say, well, what about the social costs of of the medical care or the later treatment, which you know, undoubtedly can be considerable. It's nothing very unusual for the costs of treating an extremely premature newborn to run over $1 million before the baby's even discharged from the hospital, never mind whatever, you know, problems there are that arise later. So the costs are significant, but still, if you raise the issue of costs in, as I say, in the United States, you're open to the reply, well, we should just put more money into healthcare. You know, look how much we're spending on toys for the Pentagon or whatever else it might be. Yes, that's true. I think we could put more money. We probably should put more money into healthcare. So that's why I think it's best to focus on things that are not just dollar costs that we can't overcome by putting more money into it, but that are real human costs.
Now, I've also always been troubled by the disability rights argument that there's something wrong with parents choosing prenatal selection or selective abortion to prevent bringing a disabled child into the world, both through their own personal decision-making about the burden on their life and the burden on a child. Disability rights advocates seem to argue that that is an injustice to all disabled people everywhere. And I mean, I see this as kind of that they're arguing that parents should cause disabilities in their children because it's a parental choice, right? It's you're choosing to have a disabled child or not. Mm. And so they're kind of arguing that that we don't have a parental duty to ensure that the best things for all of our children, but rather to ensure that all of our children meet some kind of quota of disabilities in society.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the you know, when you look at it in one way, you can understand why people from the disability movement say this. I mean, they're sort of saying things like, look, if my parents had done that, I wouldn't be here.
Mm-hmm.
But, well, firstly, that's a very strange argument to use because, for example, if you think that it's a good thing globally that people should have small families for the environment, then every, let's say, fourth child can also say, well, if my parents had done that, I wouldn't be here. And that's true, but, you know, you could sort of say, well, you wouldn't have ever known what you were missing.
Anyone who advocates family planning is a eugenicist in that
case. In that sense, that's right, yeah. I'm not very moved by the, you know, I wouldn't have been here argument. As for the idea that it carries the implication that life with a disability is less desirable than life without a disability, I would have to say, yes, it does carry that implication. But that implication is a justifiable one, and I find it hard to believe, despite some of the rhetoric, that people in the disability movement generally or overwhelmingly don't think that. Of course, it depends a little on what you're talking about, what disability you're talking about. But if you take someone who's confined to a wheelchair, let's say someone who has a spinal injury that means they can't use their legs, and you say to them, look, we've just discovered how to cure your condition, you know, a very simple operation, completely safe, wheel you into the hospital, 2 hours later you'll be walking. I mean, how many people in wheelchairs would say, you know, no, I'm not interested in that. My life is just as good in the wheelchair as without. So I think just by doing research into trying to overcome these disabilities, we are, as a society, saying that it's better not to have them.
Apparently, Chris Reeves has been pissing off some disability rights advocates for precisely that reason, because he's so optimistic about the possibilities of a cure that they feel that he's dishonoring the movement as a whole.
Well, I mean, that's exactly the bind they're in. And I have to say, if there are people who are pissed off with Chris Reeves for doing that, they're at least consistent if they're criticizing me and they're criticizing him. So that's true. But I don't think they're getting a very broad support for that view, even amongst you know, people who are paraplegics or quadriplegics.
And they're certainly not. You know, one of our famous American politicians once said that extremism in the pursuit of virtue is no vice. And you've often been called an extremist in your application of utilitarian ethics. Why do people expect ethics to be easy? Shouldn't ethics challenge us, make our lives uncomfortable, show the gap between where we're at and where we should be?
It should certainly do all of those things, but if you're asking, you know, why people in this society have, or a number of people, obviously not everyone, have been concerned about my appointment, I think you can't overlook the role that religion is playing here, because You know, I do not get this sort of response in Australia, where people are very familiar with my views. And one you know, sociological difference that's clear between Australia, I'm just taking that as an example, I could have picked dozens of other countries, and the United States, is that this is a country in which religion plays a much stronger role. A higher percentage of people go to church each week. You've never had a president who's been an atheist or an agnostic openly, at least as far as I'm aware. You know, we have two of the last three or four Australian prime ministers have said that they don't believe in God. It's not a political problem to do that in Australia. So the whole climate about religion is different, and I think that a lot of the opposition comes from people who you know, just assume that the Judeo-Christian ethic is one that is right and has to be supported.
Mm-hmm. You did have trouble in Germany because of the lingering concerns there about neo-Nazi attitudes, and they shut down some of your lectures there.
Yes, I think that's a different case. It's not actually lingering concerns about neo-Nazi attitudes, it's lingering concerns about Nazi attitudes. The problem is that the Nazis had a program which they described as euthanasia for essentially murdering people who were a nuisance to them, in that they were, you know, what they called useless mouths. I'm not talking about the genocide against the Jews and Gypsies. I'm here talking about a campaign to kill people with disabilities, some of whom were leading perfectly, you know, tolerable lives for them, but needed to be institutionalized or something of that sort. And, you know, that's, and in fact, you know, you can see that this was not considered really a benefit to them or to their families from the fact that the Nazis did not tell their families what had happened. They sent them little letters just telling them that their children had died. So, you know, that's totally different from what I'm espousing, which, of course, would return the possibility of making decisions to the parents, whereas what the Nazis were all about was taking it away from the parents. So I think it was a misunderstanding of my view, but I guess you can say that Germany is rightly sensitive about its past, and I would see this as a kind of a psychologically explicable overreaction to that.
Now, it's particularly ironic since you consider yourself a man of the left and have argued for radical redistribution of wealth across the world and how are we to live ethics and age of self-interest. And the Australian Greens ran you for parliament. You didn't win, I take it.
No, unfortunately not. The Greens are a small party in Australia, as they are in many other countries. But, you know, I didn't expect to win, but I wanted to get a bit more attention for green issues. And I think in that sense, the campaign was a success.
I was really taken with the article that you wrote recently in Prospect magazine. You wrote an article on the need for a Darwinian left about the underappreciation of our genetic and biological heritage on the part of the left. And you make a couple points there, the points about the need to appreciate human nature, the competitive and cooperative aspects of human nature, the need to confront the way that we exploit non-human animals and so forth, with traditional points for you. But in your last paragraph, you very tantalizingly suggest that we might modify our genes to become more altruistic. And you see this as a, you project this as a long-term political idea. But it seems like a more short-term idea, you know, the idea of identifying altruistic genes or pro-social genes and having a social policy to encourage parents to include them, or at least to exclude children who are antisocial or asocial, certainly is a project for the next generation, don't you think?
It could be a project for the next generation if we can identify what these genes are and if we, you know, then have methods of essentially choosing the genes of the following generation of children. You know, those are both quite big ifs. That is, in that it's really speculative to talk about genes for altruism, although the, you know, I think it's quite possible that there are at least combinations of genes which do code for that, finding what they are, and then actually, you know, how you go about altering the genetics of the next generation. Are you going to have couples going through in vitro fertilization so that their embryos can be screened, or are you going to have them having prenatal diagnosis and terminating the pregnancies, I don't think you'd want to be doing that on, you know, a sort of really large scale. So the other option, I guess, is to sort of try and do it by looking at or changing the gametes, the sperm and egg. But again, you know, that's all in the future as far as science is concerned. So that's why I said that it's not an immediately feasible possibility.
You mentioned the giving parents choice. One of the things that I have often said to people who object to the idea of genetic choice is that I think that in general, parents given choice over the genetic makeup of their children will choose healthier, more intelligent, and more long-lived children, and that if we allow all parents choice, we'll probably end up with very good outcomes. Is that a reasonable expectation?
I think it's reasonable that people will prefer healthy, intelligent, long-lived children. The question is, what else will they prefer? And if we have this just on a free market basis, will they, for example, prefer to have children who are going to be like some current pop celebrity, like, the same genes, maybe clones of rock singers or sports stars or whatever else it might be? That's one concern, I guess. Or just perhaps extremely successful business people, you know, we can have lots of Bill Gates running around or whatever. Another possibility is that people will get into a kind of competitive cycle or spiral here. For example, people might also want to have tall children. They might want to have children who are just a little bit taller than average because, you know, there have been studies that suggest that various advantages go along with that. You're more likely to succeed in getting to leadership positions, perhaps in various ways. Well, they might just like it for its own sake, or they might think, yeah, they'll be able to look over the heads of other people at the baseball games. But of course, you know, if once people start doing that, then you're just going to start getting taller and taller, and the whole thing will spiral upon itself. And it could have then disadvantages, like it may get to the point where you're actually unhealthy, or it may just be that humans get bigger and bigger and have to use more and more resources. You know, really from an ecological point of view, it would be much better if we were all the size of people a couple of thousand years ago when, you know, they,
4 feet tall.
Yeah, sort of a little compact human beings that could live off fewer resources would be better.
Well, I want to really say that I appreciate your coming on the air, and I hope that the controversy subsides enough so that people will begin to listen to the arguments that you're making, because they're very, very important. Do you think things are beginning to calm down a little bit for you?
I think so, yes. I mean, recently there's still media interest, but actually it seems to have been people interested in more serious stuff about the substance of my views rather than just you know, the sort of professor of death screaming headlines which were around at the time that I first took up my appointment here.
What's your current project?
Well, let me just mention, actually, since you've mentioned the Prospect article, that I developed that into a short book. It was based on a lecture I'd given in London, a book called The Darwinian Left, and that will be published by Yale University Press in this country in the spring. So that should be out soon. I'm finishing off, this is something quite different from what we've been talking about, but I'm finishing off a book about my grandfather, which is a sort of a voyage of discovery, because I never met him because he was a victim of the Holocaust. So I'm trying to reconstruct as much of his life as I can. And that, I hope will be out sometime by the end of 2000.
Excellent. Thank you very much for joining me.
Okay, it's been my pleasure.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or want to share your thoughts about the show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. Also, check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com. Check back next week at the same time for Change Surfer Radio.